This is 3:25:32. Again, the senses led by the mind act under the influence of the demigods. When the service is ultimately aimed at the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the senses are in their natural position. The Lord is called Rishikesha, for he is actually the proprietor and the ultimate master of the senses. The senses and the mind are naturally inclined to work, but when they are materially contaminated, they work for some material benefit or for the service of the demigods, although actually they are meant to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The senses are called Rishika, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead is called Rishikesha. Indirectly, the senses, all the senses, are naturally inclined to serve the Supreme Lord. That is called bhakti. Kapila Dev said that when the senses, without desire for material profit or other selfish motives, are engaged in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is situated in devotional service. That spirit of service is far better than siddhi, liberation. Or Prabhupada uses the word here, salvation. Bhakti, the inclination to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is in a transcendental position far better than mukti or liberation. Thus, bhakti is the stage above liberation. Unless one is liberated, one cannot engage the senses in the service of the Lord. When the senses are engaged either in material activities of sense gratification or in the activities of the Vedic injunctions, there is some motive. But when the same senses are engaged in the service of the Lord and there is no motive, that is called annimitta, and it is the natural inclination of the mind. The conclusion is that when the mind, without being deviated either by the Vedic injunctions or by the material activities, is fully engaged in Krishna consciousness or devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is far better than the most aspired for liberation from material entanglement. Srila Bhanuvacha Devanam Gunalinganam Anushravata Karmanam Sattva Evaika Manaso Vritik Swabhaviki Tuya Animita Bhagavati Bhakti Siddhir Gariyasi Vritti Swabhaviki. The natural function. Now it says of the demigods, Prabhupada, it is word for word sentence, says of the senses or the presiding deities of the senses. This Prabhupada gets from the commentaries on our acharyas. The word deva is usually understood to mean demigod, but in this context we're talking about the natural activity of the demigods. The natural activity is devotional service. Why should that apply only to the demigods of heaven? We understand, the devotees in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that anyone can become a devotee. You don't have to be a demigod. There's no particular great advantage of being a demigod. It doesn't make it better or easier for you to become a devotee. Some other Vaishnavas have a different slant on that. In the Madhva Sampradaya, it is their idea that the demigods are definitely the best devotees. And if you want to get liberation, if you want to become a perfect devotee, and in their conception, the perfection of devotional service is liberation. Not that liberation is only a stepping stone to devotion, but devotion is the sadhana for liberation. Liberation is the perfection. Because it's personal liberation. It means to go to Vaikuntha and engage in the service of God. But the word they use, the idea, what they're aiming for is liberation, mukti. And bhakti is the sadhana, the means. And more specifically, if you want to get that mukti, you've got to become a demigod. Not only become a demigod, you've got to go through the whole hierarchy, 100 lifetimes after another. Shatajanmana, the statement in the Bhagavatam, that by doing your prescribed duty for 100 years, you can become Lord Brahma. That's stated in the Bhagavatam. But the followers of Madhvacharya take that to mean that you have to do that. But there's no other path of liberation. You have to become Lord Brahma. Only Lord Brahma gets liberation. Everyone else is only on the waiting list. And there's 100 positions on the waiting list. You've got to move up one step at a time. It takes 100 lifetimes. Just like, according to them, Sri Vadiraj Tirtha, who was a great reformer in the Madhva line in the 15th century, he's going to become the next Vayu. And Vayu is number two on the waiting list. Now, after Vayu is next best after Brahma. Vayu in his next life, after being Vayu, he can become Brahma, and then he can get the liberation. So only the demigods are the best devotees. And if you don't become a demigod, then you're just, you know, off the waiting list. You don't even have any chance of getting a seat on the liberation train. That's not our view. That's not the teaching of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. What about Prahlad? He was a Rakshasa, son of a great demon. But we count him as one of the greatest devotees. What about the young women of Vrindavan who are just gwalas, you know, not very civilized human beings, not very prestigious position, but they're the greatest devotees. So we have to understand this verse differently, because we don't think that the demigods are the only real devotees. Being a demigod doesn't have much to do with being a pure devotee. So devas, as Prabhupada explains, because Srila, probably Sridhar Swami, and Jiva Goswami, and Vishnu, if you look at the commentaries, take it to mean the senses. But why do you call the senses devas? Because it also means the deities who rule the senses. So the natural activity of the senses is what? Well, is bhakti, devotional service. Natural. What is natural to you is what will be the easiest to do. To do something that's against your nature, that's not going to be easy. And it's not going to be good for you. It's not going to be wholesome and healthy. People get sick. People get old prematurely. People have short lives and miserable lives because they're behaving and living unnaturally, against their proper nature. Now, you should eat according to your prakriti, your constitution. You should act and work according to your constitution. What's natural? But that's just on the material level. On the spiritual level, our nature is to serve Krishna, our actual natural condition. And if we're not serving Krishna, we're asking to get sick, to be miserable, and suffer so many restrictions in our life. The symptom of that material illness, of living an unnatural life, is restriction, loss of freedom. The more sinful you are, the more rebellious you are against your natural position of being Krishna's servant. The more you try not to be Krishna's servant, the more constricted your life is, down to the position of those who are in the mode of ignorance. The dumb animals, the plants and trees, they, just when you get down to the vegetative species, then you have no ability even to move. You're stuck in one place. No matter how difficult, painful the conditions are, you can't even move away. At least we, if it's hot outside, we can move into the shade. But a tree cannot easily do that. He can shift his limbs. There's one over here in the back. Move back here. heart. And those who are, even in human bodies, those who are tamasic, they get more and more of their freedom taken away. The more sinful you are, the less freedom you're left with. And the more pious you are, the more freedom and power you're given. You can become a demigod. You can fly in the sky without having to put petrol into your gas tank. Now, without fuel, you can fly everywhere you want. We may have a vehicle, we may have a car, but if there's a shortage of petrol, we don't have money to buy it, then we can't go anywhere. Yeah, I think in Australia, what they did sometimes, they'd engage the bushman in some menial work, and then pay him by giving him a car with, you know, half a liter of petrol in the tank. And then the bushman would happily, you know, he didn't know how to drive, but he, you know, it's a desert, so he can just wander off into the desert with his car. And then after, you know, an hour of driving, the petrol went out, and he didn't know what to do. So he just abandoned the car and walked away, and then the owners of the car, the employees would come back and retrieve the car. You know, no fuel, you can't go anywhere.
Is that Australian history?
I heard about that, yeah.
Okay.
but if you can be elevated to the mode of goodness, you can have a vehicle that will drive without fuel. Just on the air. perpetual glider that can go anywhere you want, and you're free to travel practically all over the universe. If you're a grihastha, you won't be allowed without a visa into Maharloka and the upper, into Janatapal Satyaloka. They're generally only for the celibates. But beside that, in the lower regions below those celibate planets, the demigods can go anywhere they want. And they can do practically anything they want. That's freedom. The more you are sattvic, the more freedom you're given. The more tamasic you are, the less and less freedom you have. But absolute freedom is gained by living an absolutely natural way of life. Sattva, sattve. The meaning of sattvam is to abide by your true nature. Sattvam means your character, your nature, what you are. When you act as what you really are, not try to be something you're not, that is living in the mode of sattvam, goodness. What's good about it is it's natural and easy. Just like, and then you have to, I'm sorry, bhakti is that natural life, according to this definition of Kapilavastu. Although it is understood, the word bhakti has two meanings. Jiva Goswami points this out, that the word bhakti can mean the natural, perfect, spontaneous mode of living in which one senses and minds are completely engaged in the glorification and the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's the higher sense of bhakti. But there's also bhakti for those who have material attachments, who are still conditioned and don't have the spontaneous inclination to serve Krishna. For them, bhakti means the practice of bhakti, the reformatory practice of regulated devotional service. Just like healthy life is an automatic thing for someone who's not sick. You know, he already has good habits. You know, he eats nicely, he gets exercise. So just his daily routine is wholesome. It's the life he's already living. But when he gets sick, seriously, he goes to the doctor, and then the doctor sends him to the hospital, and all of a sudden he's lying in the bed and told, you know, that you can only eat this and that, and pumped full of medicines. His life has become very restricted while he's under medical treatment in the hospital. But that is also therapeutic. It is good for him. We don't conceive of it as good to have all our liberties taken away. And also for someone to come with a knife and cut us up. But when the surgeon does it, that's to save us. And when we are forced to accept the restrictions of living in the hospital, that's for making us healthy, so that we can go back out and again live our natural, normal life. It's not normal to be stuck in the hospital and go through what they make you go through there. But if it will bring you back to your normal condition, then it is the right thing for you. So the devotional practice, the discipline that revives your natural consciousness. You mean like going to the hospital? Yeah, I mean some hospital stays are horrible. Sometimes they just send you, on vacation to the sanatorium to bask in the sun and read books. The hospital stay doesn't have to be miserable. There's different kinds of hospital stays. So for some, devotional service is bad. In the sense it's horrible, it's difficult. Especially for people who are seriously ill, who are infected by the mode of tamas. For them to now engage in the discipline of bhakti yoga is painful, a struggle. Whereas someone in the mode of ignorance, a mode of goodness, chant Krishna's name, read the Bhagavatam, the payment's pleasant. It's like spending, a week in the sanatorium on vacation. For one, a hospital stay is miserable and frightening. For another, it's pleasant. Depends on who you are, what your illness is. But it is discipline. It is a therapy. It is necessary for recovering our natural condition. Even though you may think that the discipline itself, what's natural about that? But it's not that the discipline is meant to be natural. It's not that the medicine is just for your sense gratification. The medical treatment is for your sense gratification. You may have to go through some trouble, but in order to rectify it, to regain your natural condition. So bhakti means both. But the word bhakti is used to refer to the natural, easy, pleasant life of just serving God. But it also means doing whatever you have to do to regain that condition. It's also called bhakti. Because both of them are the proper use of your mind and senses. If you're sick, then the proper thing to do is to get well. Take the treatment. And if you're well, the proper thing to do is enjoy your life. So they're both bhakti. They're both, by this definition of Kapila Dev, both of them are bhakti. Both the spontaneous loving service and the disciplined practice are the natural proper use of the senses, depending on your condition. That's why he's speaking in general terms here. He was speaking even more generally before, just about liberation. Now that he's getting to the point of bhakti, he's starting with general definition of bhakti that applies both to the sadhakas and to the perfect devotees. In general, what's bhakti? We can deal with the details after we've got a general definition. General definition is this. It's the natural use of your mind and senses. And then that's the what we call tatthi sarup lakshana, the essential defining quality. The one thing that cannot be removed without destroying it. If what you're doing is in no way even indirectly connected with your natural function of serving God, then it's not devotional service. I can play the guitar for Krishna's service if I do it in an authorized way. Okay, we want to send a bhajan band to Mongolia, and they like guitar bands over there in Mongolia. So you're recruited. You used to play the guitar. Get out your guitar, practice a little bit, and we'll send you out with the bhajan band. So that's your authorized service. Being used for Krishna's service, for practical, authorized preaching work. But otherwise, you've got your guitar and you waste time playing it for no good reason. That's not devotional service. Same activity. It has to be, the essential characteristic that must be there is that it must be fulfilling your real function of being a servant of God. It must be tied into the service of God, directly or indirectly. Indirectly, maybe. Those who perform Vedic sacrifices are indirectly worshipping the Supreme Lord. Ye tu anya devata bhakta. Those who are devotees of other demigods. Yajante, they perform Vedic sacrifices. Yaj means to perform Vedic sacrifice. Shraday Amvita, and they're full of faith. I'm missing a few words, but they're worshipping me actually. But it's not the direct process. It's not the way I prefer. Yeah. Okay, they can worship Indra, pour some oblations and chant some mantras, and I get my share of the sacrifice. I get the first share. Yageshwara, Krishna understands. So okay, even though he's not thinking of me, at least he's worshiping me through my representative, Indra, and other demigods. So it's indirect devotional service. Vedic, following the Vedic process of sacrifice is Krishna's subconsciousness. You're not aware, but you're doing it. You're serving Krishna indirectly through his representative. Either way, directly or indirectly, consciously, unconsciously, if it's, it has to be for the pleasure of the Lord. Otherwise, there's no way to call it any kind of bhakti. That's the essential characteristic. But then Kapila also gives some additional characteristics. Maybe there, may not be there. But if you want the best bhakti, you should have the additional characteristics. Animita. Bhagavati. Actually, that's just the one. Animita. Best kind of devotional service has to be causeless. If you've got material ulterior motives, then you may be doing devotion, but it's mixed devotion. It's compromised devotion. That can also be called a kind of bhakti. Karma Mishra Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti. You can have Yoga Mishra Bhakti. You want to be a yogi. You want to have the title yogi after your name. You want to be able to twist your body as a pretzel in various ways. You want people to respect you for that. You want to make a living on it. You're a yogi, okay, but you are worshipping the Lord, and you realize that that's the real goal of life. But you've got this mixed motivation. You also want to be a yogi, or you want to be a jnani, or you want to be a karmi. You know that the goal of life is to leave this world. You know it theoretically, but you're not ready for it yet. Maybe in the next lifetime, or maybe a couple of lifetimes. I've still got business here. I'm still not done enjoying. So then you're a karma mishra bhakta. You know, you're worshipping Krishna, you're chanting his names. You know that the real goal of life is just to do everything for him only. Still, you're not ready to leave this world. So jnana mishra, karma mishra. Jnana mishra bhakti means you want liberation. That's your motive. They're also called bhakti. They're special, they're an inferior variety of bhakti, but they're still bhakti. Mediocre music is still music. Mediocre poetry is still called poetry. There's a point at which someone's words are not poetry at all, they're just prose, or even incoherent, gibberish. But you can have bad or second-class poetry, bad music, mediocre music, and then first class music. They're all called music or poetry. Like that, you can have first class devotion, you can have second and third and fourth class devotion also. That's called Mishra Bhakti. So if you leave out the animita part, then that's a very general definition of all kinds of bhakti. It's bhakti, that's the essential definition. It's got to be natural inclination and directed toward Bhagavati. That other term is there. If it's not directed toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but to someone less than that, it's not bhakti. Call it something else. Don't call it bhakti. If it's for a demigod, or it's for your country, or for your family, it's not bhakti. You have no right to properly call it bhakti. If you do, you're misusing the word. Deshbhakta. It does not exist in the Sanskrit language. Although it's the Hindi. In the Hindi dictionary it means patriot. But there were no Deshbhaktas in the original Sanskrit culture. Yasyatma buddhi kuna patriotatake. Sadiq kalatratish. Bolna ijidi. Someone who thinks that his land is worshipable, according to the Bhagavatam, Seva go karaha. You can say that means he's a cow or a donkey, who are not, it means stupid, very stupid. But Vishnu Chakravarti gives another explanation of that. There's donkeys, some donkeys are high class donkeys. They have a master, they work for Adobe, you know, and they sit around most of the day and only, you know, once or twice a day have to carry the laundry. But then there's the gokara, the donkey that has to carry all the grass for the cows. He's carrying, you know, all day going back and forth with loads of grass. That's a very stupid donkey. Yeah, gokara. The cow's ass. Someone who thinks that his land is worshipable. The so-called Deshbhakta. He's a jackass. So eva gokara. So bhakti, only proper use of the word, even if it's mixed devotion, has to be directed to the Supreme Lord. But then if you leave out the nimitta phrase, you can have some sort of mixed devotion, and it's still devotion, but it's second, third, fourth class. So here Kapiladev is giving his general definition, and if you include the word animita, then he's defining pure devotional service. Srila Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is writing his book about pure devotional service. In the very beginning he defines Shuddha Bhakti. Very similar to this definition. Anyabhilashita Shunyam, that's the animita. Jnana Karma Adhyanabhitam, that's the swabhaviki, natural. Anukulyena Krishna, Anushilana, practicing how to serve Krishna in a favorable way. That's Bhaktir Uttama, first class Bhakti or Shuddha Bhakti, unmixed. That's Rupa Goswami's definition. He gives that at the beginning of his book because that's all he's interested in his book, in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, is pure devotion. But the Vaishnavas can discuss. It's not a forbidden or obscene topic to discuss mixed devotional service. Krishna discusses the different kinds of mixed devotional service in his instructions to Uddhava. Lord Kapila is going to describe various kinds of mixed devotional service to his mother also in later chapters. And even Jiva Goswami, following Rupa Goswami, when he wrote his expanded explanation in the Bhakti Sandarbha. In the earlier sections of that Bhakti Sandarbha, he discusses various kinds of mixed devotional service, even though Rupa Goswami didn't. So it's not a forbidden or completely rejected topic. But the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is our textbook, our manual for practice, is only about pure, unmotivated devotional service. We may have some theoretical interest in the other kinds, but as far as what we're interested in doing, what those in the line of Rupa Goswami are meant to do is only the practice of Shuddha Bhakti. Sometimes we have to tolerate devotees going off into the mixed modes of devotion. What can we do? Devotional service is voluntary. But when you do that, you're straying away from the path of Rupa Goswami. When you allow your karma and jnana to become very prominent in your life, you're not any longer really following the path of Rupa Goswami. You can call it bhakti, but it's not the pure path. Pure path, as established by Rupa Goswami and as implemented for us by Srila Prabhupada, is not to let ourselves become too much influenced by these tendencies of karma, jnana, or yoga, or whatever else may be interesting us. We have to put them aside or minimize them as much as possible. The jnana interest, the karma interest, the yoga interest. And make our interest only making Krishna happy. Okay, so I'll stop. Are there any questions or comments?
Three questions. Number one, in the purport, at least twice, Srila Prabhupada contrasts following Vedic injunctions with performing eternal activities.
Yeah.
That seems to imply that the following Vedic injunctions are not material, and yet Krishna equally implies in Bhagavad Gita that this is all just cycling and you should be done with it.
Yeah. I think I understand what Baba's doing there. He's saying that, you know, worshipping demigods or doing sacrifice is also a kind of devotion. I see. He's contrasting devotion with material activity. Mm-hmm. Devotional service is the natural use of your mind and senses. Mm-hmm. Whereas, contrasted to that is unnatural. There's two kinds of unnatural uses of the mind and senses. One is to worship demigods.
Sakama.
If you call it Sakama Bhakti, but really when you've got strong material motives and you don't have much motive for devotion, then you're not practicing Karma Mishra Bhakti, you're practicing maybe Bhakti Mishra Karma. Mm-hmm. When the karma motive is more than half. You know. When the bhakti motive becomes 50% more, then it's karma mishra bhakti. But when the karma is more karma motivation than bhakti, then it's, if there's any bhakti, it's still bhakti mishra karma. That's the mood of most performers of Vedic sacrifice. There may be a little devotion there, but it's not enough to make it that you can really call it bhakti. So that's worship of demigods. People in the Vedic system, cultured, civilized people who are following the Vedic path, they're worshipping demigods and performing rituals of sacrifice. Whereas people outside the pale, barbarians, are not even doing that. They're just engaged in gross material activity and not worshipping any demigod or anybody. Maybe they go to church, maybe went to church on Sunday. You know, but that's just a show.
Yeah. So that kind of leads, that principle kind of leads to my second question, which is, you may have someone who has complete conviction, who believes fully in the principle of pure bhakti, although he cannot live up to this ideal fully. And at the same time, he neither is he able by dint of his karma to manifest or to engage a great deal of good karma or good piano or even yoga in a mixed way in that endeavor.
Yes.
On the other hand, you have a mixed devotee who may be absolutely accomplished in either karma or piano.
Yes.
If we emphasize the fact that they're all devotees, then which one is better?
Oh. The devotee who all sincerity wants to just be Krishna's surrender devotee, but he's not very competent at it. You know, maybe he had bad background or just no training in living like a civilized human being. And then the person who's so-called civilized knows all the mantras and the tantras, but he doesn't. You know, for him, devotion is just part of the mix.
So we get these. References,
so which is better? Yeah.
We get these references, Vaishnava, Guru Nasya, and mantra, tantra, visharada, etc. But at the same time, there's quite a lot of people who are actually interested, at least as an ideal, in pursuing pure bhakti, but they just don't come up to snuff.
Well, what makes somebody really a Vaishnava?
Exactly.
The one who is a Vaishnava, he's actually satisfying Krishna. He's the one who should be honored as the better one. Whether either category, you might have someone who, is on the ball and knows all the Vedic stuff. And has been living a pure life, and he's sort of weak on the devotion. He doesn't need it so much. He's got everything together, but he can be a Vaishnava. It's not that he's automatically not a Vaishnava. And the person who's the person who comes from a barbarian background but is sincere, that he's automatically the Vaishnava. Either one could be a better Vaishnava. What's the actual criterion? Is that you're a servant to the servant. You become a Vaishnava by becoming the surrendered disciple of a Vaishnava. Yeah. One who is a devotee of my devotee is my devotee, and one who isn't, I don't care what he is not my devotee. So that's the difference. If you want pure devotional service, you got to take the guidance of a pure devotee and get his blessings by being empowered, by pleasing and becoming empowered by the pure devotee. You are allowed to engage in pure devotional service, even if you're a rascal, even if you're, you know, a bhattacharya who's done everything right all your life. You still can be qualified if you surrender to the pure devotee. Whether you're Joe Schmo or you know, a Sanjay Bhattacharya, you know, it doesn't matter. Either one can surrender to the pure. And if either one doesn't, if he goes off and does his own thing, then he's not a Vaishnava.
Seems like, you know, although the references that we hear in Shastra talk about, you know, if you have X or Y qualifications that are not a Vaishnava, but it doesn't seem like we very often hear so much this actually, in fact, a much larger category of people who are interested in Krishna consciousness, that this can't seem to purify themselves very easily from this lower tendency that's making more consideration.
Yes. Well, Krishna sees their sincerity. Even if his behavior is awful, if he's got every sincere intention to be my pure devotee, then Krishna considers him a sadhu.
I guess that's why.
But the key to becoming successful is to serve Krishna through by serving his devotees.
Are you
right? Yes. And do
you say? Yeah, and I guess that's why it's very important for the rest of us to try not to be very judgmental.
Yeah. Yeah. What a person's intentions are.
Maybe
that's what Krishna judges the most.
Like George Harrison, you know, would appear to have been attached to so many things, but at the same time, he expresses very profound realization.
Yeah, and Prabhupada had some nice feelings for him. Chanting Hare Krishna in the end, wasn't he? Or
yeah.
In Benares, but...
I've been in a car accident and he's not chanting Hare Krishna.
Oh.
Wake up call.
Yeah.
Anyway, the last question is that in the second canto, chapter 10, this idea of the demigods as the presiding deity of senses is a little bit emphasized just after that, just after the 10 topics are described. I don't know if you're familiar with that section. Discuss the
yes.
Well,
that's a very, very complicated topic. It's discussed at the end of the Tattva Sandarbha. What do you want to know about it? These are certain demigods. There's a special category of demigods. I think they're called Ajana. So anyway, they're the demigods that preside over the senses and the elements. Not every demigod is in that category.
Right. Like the sun is the dominating sight, right?
Yes. Well, what about them?
I just curious if you kind of didn't want to elaborate on that interesting concept. I think we don't really have that so much, but certainly not in Western science.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's why, one reason why you'd want to worship these personalities, because they're intimately involved in your personal life. You can't without, you know, what the idea of the demigod worship is that we can't live our life. We you know, we're not going to get our crops unless we worship Indra. But even more immediately, we can't lift our finger without the sanction and blessing of some demigod.
Yeah, you can't put a crop without the crop. You
know, yeah.
The crops you want in the world, but you can't get them. You're not going to help
it. Yes. So like we worship, you know, the fire, the demigod who rules the fire of digestion, because we want to devour huge amounts of food and we enjoy doing that. So we worship the Jataragni. Yeah. It's actually Vishnu. Yeah, watering the rudra tree is much more effective than
trying to deal separately with each leaf and all the branches. That's the third chapter of the second canto. Talk about if you want this, you can worship this, yeah. Then you want that one, worship that one. But, if you're smart, if you've got broad intelligence, Moksha kama udara di. If you're not narrow minded, if your mind is broad, then you're gonna do what's the best thing for yourself and your own self interest. And whether you're selfish or not, worship the Supreme Lord. Even if you've got the selfishest motives, the most effective way to get them fulfilled, even the most materialistic motive, is to go to the Supreme Lord with it.
So
mixed emotion is definitely better than plain karma, worshipping demigods. So, we have to tolerate this Satyanarayan Katha and all these mixed versions of devotional service, because it's better than being a plain demigod worshiper or a plain karmi. But it's not our line of devotional service. We don't do that in our ISKCON temples, these materialistic, yagyas. Even for Narayana.
Yes?
We're not supposed to. It doesn't please Rupa Goswami, it doesn't please Prabhupada. Our ashrams and temples are for the propagation of Nam Sankirtan, not a materialistic worship.
Anamita Bhakti.
Yes, Anamita Bhakti. What's Anamita Bhakti? What's the practice based on Nam Sankirtan?
That's why I think that Krishna Chakra Thakur is very nicely describing the characteristics of devotion. Bhakti is very nicely elaborating on how it's absolutely positive. That's a very central principle.
Yes. Central, yeah.
Love
you can have devotion that has material causes, but it's not pure. To be pure, it's got to be causeless. Okay, yes,
ma'am. For example, Gita Mahajan describes, we can see from the potency of reciting Bhagavad Gita, even one shlok of Bhagavad Gita.
Yes.
And it describes how one even becomes liberated.
Yes.
So does that mean? And you spoke about how some Vaishnavas say that in order to get liberation, you have to go for that steps.
Yes.
So does that mean that they do not recognize, do not acknowledge?
Yes. Mahapashari, Govinday, Namakamani, Vaishnavi. They've got. If they think you've got to. Go through the hierarchy of demigodry. They seriously think that. That means they have weak faith in Govinda and his name and his Mahaprasadam and the Vaishnavas. Because you can bypass all of that by taking shelter of those. Of Krishna, his name, his Mahaprasadam and his devotees. Yeah. They're not obliged to anybody anymore.
Does Mahatma, for example, Bhagavad Gita Mahatma is coming from Sampurana?
Yeah, that's Skanda Purana. That one is Skanda Purana.
In general,
and Padma Purana has another one, yeah.
And in general, Bhagavad Gita, obviously, do accept Puranas?
Yeah, but if they see a description of immediate liberation, they have to explain it. I don't know what they got an explanation for everything. Mm-hmm. We can pull anything out of the Bhagavatam and the Mudbites will explain it their way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're real smart at that. I don't know what their explanation of this is when it says that some rascal just recited three words of the Gita from one chapter and got immediate liberation. They'll say that in his last life he was almost perfect. He just had he was Vayu in his last life. Or he's going to have to he'll get liberation after 100 lifetimes.
But how is it that someone who has cultivated the consciousness necessary to get the adhikar for birth is Vayu, how is he suddenly going to turn into a rascal in the next life? It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
But by the same
from our point of view, it doesn't.
With the same argument, you have to be careful because you can say, they'll turn it around, and I've argued with monks before to do this. And therefore you cannot argue both sides of this point. And if you're going to say like that, then you also cannot say that somebody who's actually remotely qualified can take birth in a life of them.
Well, what I've heard from them is that your birth may be circumstantial. You may have some superficial covering of tumas. You just said, but when you scrape it off, you'll find stuff underneath. So someone may be, you know, they say, well, it's kind of devotees, they must have been mudvites in their last life. You know, they must have actual mudvite constitutions. And they're just superficially barbarians. Yeah, you know, but you know, with a little bit of rectification, that garbage on the outside is scraped off. Yeah, so they understand that what you see on the outside may not be what's deeper inside. So they can explain to Lodge and other devotees like him in that way. How are you doing?
Yeah.
I was a busy smoking sitar player in Calcutta. They can't do it with certainty.
Necessarily,
yeah.
No matter what you do,
you can, maybe through hypnosis, you can get people to remember their last lives.
Yeah.
You generally don't
want
to.
Prabhupada
would talk to a barking dog and say, serve you right.
Yeah.
Yeah, some dog is barking at Prabhupada.
Yeah.
Prabhupada just walked up and serves you right for what you did.
Yamuna said that when she was in Vrindavan, she saw Prabhupada arguing with monkey one day.
Oh.
She said that Prabhupada was speaking in perfect monkey bhasha.
Wow.
Yeah. Now you want to take it.
No, he said to hire someone.
cut
all the wires in the loudspeakers.
Hire the middle of the night. That's the Indian system, right? You hire some Zumbas.
Yeah.
They'll never tell who.
Yeah.
Now we are left with
like plans.